Okay, good afternoon. As lots of you know, my name is Lindsay Jones. I'm the director of the Center for the Study of Religion, and I'm first begin by turning on the mic, which is on now, right? Okay, excellent. Thank you, Michael. Because as we were talking, we know there are abundant searches going on, each of which leads to abundant talks, each of which leads to abundant competition for your time. So I'm really happy that you included this in your schedule, and I'm very pleased that Shahzad Bashir has agreed to make the trip from Stanford. And momentarily, I'm going to turn the floor over to my colleague Parvaneh Por Shariati from the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures to introduce him. But I wanted to remind you first that today's talk is the third in a series of six at-large lectures, which, as our little poster says, are lectures wherein the Center for the Study of Religion invites eminent scholars from a variety of disciplines to present their current work and reflect upon the broader challenges at issue in the academic study of religion. And among the principles, several principles of selection for these talks, over the past three or four years, we wanted to make sure that at least one of the talks had in some way to deal with Islam. So we're meeting that requirement today, but in a way very different from other ways we have in the past. So that's among the reasons that I'm very pleased that you're here. And I also, if you'll see the flyer that's on the little table here that announces all six of these talks, you'll see that this is the third one, which is to say that we're asymmetrical insofar as in the fall we had just two, and in the spring semester we'll have four. So I'm not going to mention all of those, but I want to bring to your attention the next one, because it's just 3 weeks away, exactly 3 weeks from today on February 7th, at this same time, in this same room, when we will have a scholar of religion and literature from Lafayette College named Eric Ziolkowski. Will be here, and his talk is entitled A Pearl, Two Stones, Three Rings, Genealogy of a Religious Pluralist Parable. So I hope I see all of you then. Okay. Also, I just want to mention on this table, there's a small brochure about the center there that I'd invite you to pick up when you go, and then you can take a look at our website and find out what's happening. But I should mention also on the brochure, there's a small bit of misinformation now, insofar as tomorrow the office of the Center for the Study of Religion is moving. So we have been on the first floor of University Hall, and we are going to move to the fourth floor of Hagerty Hall. So that's a step up in some world. So we don't deal with a lot of foot traffic, but if you're looking for the office, the office is moving. Okay. In any event, then there's food in the back. That was my last little note to myself, and I will turn over the floor to Parvaneh to introduce our speaker.
Okay, thanks very much.
Good afternoon. Thank you all for being here. I think that we're going to have a real treat in having Professor Shahzad Bashir amongst us and at the lecture at large. That is organized by the Center for Religious Studies. It is, in fact, really a distinct pleasure for me to introduce Professor Bashir to you. And I will be very, very brief, just so that you will sort of see the trajectory of his academic involvement. Professor Bashir is coming to us as the Lisbeth Warren Anderson Professor of Islamic Studies in the Department of Religious Studies at Stanford University. His research and publications have thus far focused on the religious history of Persianate Islamic societies of Iran and Central Asia and South Asia, with particular emphasis on late medieval and early modern periods. From 2009 to 2011, Professor Bashir was the director of the prestigious Soheib and Sara Abbasi program in Islamic studies at Stanford University. He finished his graduate work at Yale University, where for his PhD thesis, he wrote a dissertation entitled, and this sort of gives you the sort of the plateau on which I think Shahzad moves, and his dissertation was called Between Mysticism and Messianism, The Life and Thought of Muhammad Nurbakhshi, which he finished at 1998. He was given the Best Dissertation Prize of the Foundation for Iranian Studies by the Foundation for Iranian Studies. Just to give a comparison and to recognize where I stand vis-a-vis him, I got the honorable mention of some other year. So, at any rate, Shahzad Bashir has really, in what I think is a very tender young age, I think he's much younger than I am, he has had a numerous really great fellowships. He is coming to us from Guggenheim, Simon Guggenheim Memorial Fellowship in 2011 and 2012, on which he worked on the project, the sort of first preliminary results of which we will be hearing today. He was at the same time at 2011-2012 at the Stanford Humanities Center, and for 2 years, from 2004 to 2006, he was a research fellow of the Council of Learned Societies. He has been a twice recipient of the National Endowment for Humanities for faculties, and he has gotten the Mellon Sawyer postdoctoral fellowships, and so on and so forth. And then he lists a number, quite a bit of, like around a dozen, what he calls lesser grants in his extensive resume. Shahzad Bashir, besides having published numerous articles, substantive articles, thus far, has published 3 books and 1 edited book. The first one of these was again on messianic hopes and mystical visions of the Nurbakhshiye between the medieval and modern times. He wrote a monograph as well on Fazlullah Asarabadi and the Hurufis. Asarabadi was, in Bashir's words, an Islamic religious leader who believed that the world was about to come to an end and that he was appointed the final divine messenger of it. That book was published by Oxford One World Publication in 2005, and it was translated into Turkish shortly thereafter as, you know, Fazlullah Asarabadi ve Hurufilik. Shahzad has also published Sufi Bodies, Religion and Societies in Medieval Islam, which came out from the Columbia University Press in 2011. Just to show you the sort of the breadth of his expertise and the ease with which he moves from the Persianate to the Islamicate world and vice versa, and the intersection of those and the medieval and the modern period, is his co-edited volume called Under the Drones: Modern Lives in Afghanistan-Pakistan Borderlands, which has come out from Harvard University Press in 2002. Professor Shahzad Bashir has sort of had a very extensive itinerary of academic presences from Qatar to Turkey to Sweden to Germany to England and Canada. And he has, that is internationally, and he has moved nationally in various academic institutions in the States, from Harvard to Yale to University of Michigan and to Denison. He has gone all around, and we are very, very pleased that he chose to come to Columbus and Ohio State University in his extensive itinerary. One thing that I want to end with is I want to just give you a sense of how, in fact, Professor Bashir moves in his academic conceptual framework. And I want to read what he wrote when he was awarded the Guggenheim Fellowship about the project, part of which this is going to be his talk for us today. He said in the abstract that he has given to the Guggenheim, which was last year, part of that abstract read, "This funding would enable me to work on a book project in which I explore the past as an aspect of the social imagination of the Persianate Islamicate societies during the period 1400 to 1600. I intend to approach the topic thematically, focusing on the following areas: the simultaneous use of different calendars that indicates the availability of multiple pasts and futures for constructing identities in the present, the overwhelming significance of the principle of lineage through which the past is imagined as a series of interconnected bodies, the use of poetry to endow representation of the past with sentiment and trans-historical ideals, and what we can learn about literary subjectivity by paying attention to the use of first-person voice in narratives concerned with the past." I believe that reflecting, Professor Bashir maintains, on epistemological, socio-historical, and aesthetic questions associated with these themes would lead to a cultural history useful for thinking about the relationship between memory, knowledge, and literature in Islamic context and beyond. It is with delight, tremendous delight, that I would like to ask you to join me to welcome Professor Shahzad Bashir in this lecture at large series, and I am sure that we are going to be in for a major treat. Please.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. And I'm not sure whether this is actually true or not, but I can only imagine that my face is as red as a beet at this point after this introduction. Thank you so very much, Professor Khushayati, for a most generous introduction, and also to Professor Jones for the invitation. It's a real pleasure to be here. As Professor Khushayati mentioned, I'm working on this book, and what I'm going to be presenting today is one part of that book. And in all previous cases when I've worked on projects, presenting is one of the best things to do, because one, it forces me to actually produce an argument, and two, input and feedback from people who listen has been really formative in terms of how the project actually develops. So I'm really looking forward to it, and I'm really grateful for you for the fact that you have come and are willing to listen to this. So as Professor Khushayati has already mentioned, so this project is about trying to write a cultural history of the past in Persian societies circa 1400 to 1600 of the Common Era. And so what I'm trying to do is to look at the past as an object of the present. Now, of course, this is a very common thing in studies of historiography will begin often with this issue, that although the past seems to reference something that happened in long ago or in a different time, in effect, all pasts are actually products of given presents. So what I want to do is to basically take this idea and look at how people writing in this period in these societies actually imagine the past, And through that imagination, write a cultural history of the period itself. Now, there's multiple steps involved here. It's looking at the past that is within, the present that is there, and then the fact of my own present, trying to look back at these things. So it leads to, in some ways, it's a cultural history in which I'm really trying to illuminate this particular socio-historical context, but it also is fundamentally connected to the question of what the past is for us as modern historians as well. So this is why epistemologically it's not so much, not just about the epistemologies that I'm trying to extract from the materials, but also the epistemologies that we actually deploy as modern historians in thinking about these materials. So one of the critical things here is the question of time, and time and narrative performance. So my basic presupposition there is following the works of other theoreticians, that time is something that becomes real, that becomes narratable, only through reference to something that is material, or that is something outside of time. Time itself is an abstraction. It can be shown through bodies, it can be shown through the movement of heavens, it can be shown through emotion, etc. Time itself is something that is fundamentally elusive, but its traces are always present in the way it's narrated. And narration itself is then connected to time, because it happens in narrative happens in time. But one of the major points that is productive is to think about the difference between narrative time and any kind of chronometric time. And I will explain this a bit more when I get to the examples that I will show you. The other thing that happens is that if time has to be referred to through some external entity, what we end up with is talking about metaphors. Time has to be metaphorized in one way or the other. So in some ways, what I'm trying to do is to lay out or to extract or to elucidate the cultural life of metaphors, the predominant metaphors that condition and that make the past presentable and understandable in this context. So what I've tried to do is to try to look at everything that I can lay my hands on, textual genres of various types. One of the things is that in discussions of Islamic historiography, the vast majority of discussion has really been about texts that are called chronicles of various types. But I want to break away from that. So that's one type of presentation of time. But all other texts also are based upon presumptions regarding time. There are alternative timescales, such as hagiographies. There are also timescales fundamentally involved in all kinds of prosopographies, lives of scholars, painters, calligraphers, and so on and so forth. All literary texts presume things about time. So I want to construct this idea by looking across different genres and putting them together. One of the nice things about this period is that it's very rich in painting. And so looking at painting as well as a source for trying to understand this, the painting that you see on the screen here, and this is on the poster as well, so this actually emblematizes in some ways what I mean by the past as a product. So this is showing Abul Fazl, the author of the Akbarname, presenting the text to the king. Seems not to be working, but you can sort of see the king sitting in under the canopy, and the presentation is of a book. The past is fundamentally an object, a text, and it's connected, therefore, to ideological circumstances in which it is produced. And again, I will elucidate on this a little bit. And the other thing I want to do is very much not to say that I can extract time or notions of time from these texts, but to look at these materials, the material manifestations of time, as parts of a larger cultural argument that is happening over these two centuries in this cultural sphere. So I'm fundamentally interested in symptomatic readings of these things, oblique readings of what is going on, rather than taking simply these, whether texts or paintings, on their surfaces. Eventually, then, we get to the questions of identities, ideologies, and the past, and that identity and ideology are inextricable from notions of the past in all societies, I imagine. But here, I think there's a particular relationship in what comes to be constituted as Persian societies in this period. Now, so to begin with, what does one mean by Persianate in this period? So this shows a kind of a general map of the Middle East and South Asia, and the area that is covered in color is what I mean by Persianate societies in this context. Basically, what is now Iran, the Caucasus, Afghanistan, Central Asia, and down into India, the North India, and also South India. And for me, the area is joined through the production of literary materials in Persian. And we have tremendous amount of evidence of people writing to each other, people moving between these areas, people reflecting on the fact of being in one place or the other. We have major literary centers such as Herat, which I will talk about today, but also Delhi, also Ahmedabad in Gujarat, also Samarkand, Tabriz, etc. So, and there are, we have a very substantial amount of material to be able to do this, and we know that all these places are actually interconnected because we have lives that refer to them in moving through it. Now, today what I will do is to focus on the heart of all of this, Herat, the city of Herat in contemporary Afghanistan. Now, Herat is particularly interesting for this purposes for a number of reasons. First, it is a major center, major urban center. Furthermore, Herat is host to a court, the court of Hussein Baikara, a Timurid ruler from about 1470 to 1506. This court comes to be associated with great efflorescence of literature, of art, of calligraphy, and all kinds of things cultural. It actually, basically, sometimes one might even think it is a bit like a Renaissance place in which previous ideas are reproduced in many different ways. We have lots and lots of manuscripts in there, but also they are transformed, put into new forms, and so on. So looking at the material produced in Herat gives us a kind of a concentrated sense on these questions at the moment. Moreover, in the period after the end of this court in 1506, the states that succeed this court, the Mughal society of Mughal state in India, the Safavids in what eventually comes to be Iran, the Uzbeks in Central Asia, to some degree perhaps even the Ottomans, Herat represents this memory of the great culture that is that people try to replicate. Manuscripts produced in Herat in this period are greatly prized, and we find them in Mughal treasuries and Safavid treasuries. And many of the patterns that get celebrated as the glory of the past actually are located, can be located in Herat. So Herat has a particular charge for thinking about questions of the past and of nostalgia. Now here is a painting of the court of Herat. This is done in 1488. It's ascribed to Behzad, the greatest name in painting in medieval Persianate societies. So just the opulence of this painting gives us some sense of the opulence of the court and the cultural atmosphere that went with it. I don't think you can probably notice this from the distance and the way this is projected at the moment, but there are fundamental patterns that unite this double painting to the painting of the Akbarname that is being produced 100 years later in Agra. The way the king is seated and the various characters and the way they are shown. So I'm interested in these continuities and changes that are happening in these patterns that we can see in painting and certainly in text as well. So what I want to do is to give you a concrete sense for what I'm talking about by speaking about three particular texts. At the end of the day, my greatest investment is not in giving just an abstract argument about all this, but to share and to demonstrate some of the texture of the materials, because that's really what motivates me. Where I got started with this project was by reading these texts and just being kind of fascinated by the actual affective projections that are present there. And so this is what I will try to show you, and that can only be done by specific examples, obviously. So I've chosen three texts that show the past in very different ways. The first one is the Universal Chronicle. Riyasuddin Khwandamir's Habib al-Sayf Yahbori Afrad al-Bashar. It's a universal history from the beginning of time to the moment in which it's written. It's the first time in 1524 in Herat, The author then moved to India, to Agra, and there's a second version done in 1529. Ghiyasuddin Khwandamir is the greatest chronicler of the period. He's the greatest name. He wrote multiple universal chronicles, wrote many other texts as well, and is just one of the great names, literators, as well as an administrator for both the Timurid and the Mughals, and also for the Safavids in various points in his life. The second one is a local narrative about the city of Herat by Muinuddin Al-Istrazari, Rawzat al-Jamaat fi Awsaf Madinat Herat. This is probably the most detailed text on Herat from this period, but it organizes time in a very different way. And the third one is a poetic memoir, Zainuddin Wasifi's Badawi al-Baqai, written a little bit later in Tashkent. And for me, these texts exemplify, or they're very interrelated, and all these people knew each other in one way or the other. But they exemplify different aspects of the constructions of the past. Now, so the first thing, so this is the first one, is the Khwandamir's Habib al-Siyar. Now, so in the very beginning of the text, he says that I was commissioned to write this this history, this universal history, and then the patron who had commissioned it was killed in a political intrigue. And then he has some poetry that kind of exemplifies his sorrow at the passing of this patron. And what he says is, again, and of course in my translation, the collar of patience torn from that sorrow, reed pen on the ground, from grief thrown away. The inkpot in anger turned one with soot, its mouth opened with the intensity of grief. It was overcome, becoming the picture of surprise, finger in its mouth, the pen a mark of dismay. When the pen's tongue came out, unmoist, that pain had caused it to become dumb. A tear dropped down and marked the page, tulips grew from eyes' blood, adorning the blank surface, splayed. Brides of speech rushed away, hiding behind veils, closing away the doors of hope they had earlier faced. Now, first of all, this is highly emotional poetry, but the critical thing that the reason I brought this in is the question here we see the relationship between ink and blood, that the pen is connected to blood fundamentally. When the pen, ink and blood are substitutable entities in various ways, the flowing of the blood of the patron actually when the head is severed of the patron, essentially the pen starts to flow with blood rather than with ink. So writing is fundamentally connected to the question of patronage, and also connected to relationships between individuals and how they see themselves. And this is one of the places where we can see this this notion of the connection between ink and blood is played out again and again. And some other examples I will show will show this as well. The other thing is in this is here you can see the question of the use of metaphors. So this notion of the ink pot becoming like it's a being, it's personified with its mouth open with the intensity of grief, and the pen in the ink pot becomes like the finger in the mouth showing dismay and surprise, which is a Persian idiom, right? So there's an immense amount of this constant use of literalization of idioms and of language that are intimately a part of the writing about the past, as we see here. Now, further down, he says that after that, he acquired a new patron by the name of Khwaja Karim bin Habibullah Safavi, who was the vizier of the Safavids. And this man is actually responsible why the name of the work is Habib al-Siyar, and it's named after Habibullah Safavi. So here then he says, well then how did I start actually write this book? So he says, the sun's sphere was in the throes of sorrow, the talkative nightingale become a prisoner. Silenced by the autumn that was the oppression of fate, it was speechless, separated from the beneficent rose. Suddenly a spring wind began to blow, and there arrived the fragrance of the garden, your grace. Once the workshop turned into your rose garden, the sad heart was gladdened, losing the pricking thorn that was the cause of its pain. Once again it was accosted by the memory of speech. It began to articulate words in your praise. This wondrous speech is, I hold hope, like a knot of pearls brought to order. It will aid in making manifest what is hidden, presented to the skillful, those unmarred by flaws. The measure of generosity is infinite grace. It works to correct errors inscribed by the pen. So here we again have this relationship of the patron, and what enables the pen to write is the grace of the patron, and the flow of ink in a very literal material way is connected to the grace being provided by the patron. And towards the end then, the audience comes in as well, and the audience is able to appreciate it and in the societal context in which it is occurring. Part of the reason I'm giving these examples of poetry is to, again, to show you some of the texture of how this is narrated. Now, so this is a very close look at very little bits of text. Now, if we pan out, how is this text laid out? So what I've done here is to give you the whole structure of this text. It's in three volumes, in printed form, it's in four volumes. So it's very large. It's about, I think, about 2,500 printed pages. And it tells the story from the beginning of time to the point at which it is being written. So whatever abstract creation to 1524 when he stops writing. Now here are some of the things that we see in representations of times are straightforward, beginning with pre-Islamic prophets, so creation, Adam, and the various prophets from the Bible. But then, immediately after that, there is a section equally long on pre-Islamic Persian and Arab kings. Then we have Muhammad, the four caliphs, and then 12 Shi'i imams. So we are going between religious genealogies, political genealogies, both Arab and Persian, the prophet, a very Sunni view of history with the four caliphs, then the 12 Shi'i imams. And then on top of that, Umayyads, who are actually opposed to the 12 Shi'i imams, the Abbasids, and then the local dynasties that were concurrent with Abbasid rule in volume 2. In volume 3, the history of Chinggis Khan, then the Chinggis Khan's descendants, the Chinggisids, then Timur, Tamerlane, and his descendants, the Timurids, which again he stops at 1524, and after that, that is the line that continues on to the Mughals. And then Shah Ismail, who is the actual king for whom he's writing, because he's in Safavid domains at the time when he first composes this book. And again, he follows it until 1524 there. And then we have towards the future. Now, there are many, many interesting things here, but you can sort of see the interlacing of religious and non-religious genealogies. Fundamentally, though, the issue is genealogy. Past is connected to human bodies that can be interconnected in some way. In many ways, in many cases, it's physical genealogies of dynasties, etc. In other cases, it's actually fictive genealogies, the way prophets can be connected together to each other, the four caliphs, who are not genealogically related. And then other dynasties as well. Now, where I put out the yellow lines under Shah Ismail, Timur and the Timurids, Chinggis Khan, Muhammad, and pre-Islamic Arabic and Persian kings, that's where his focal point is. Ultimately, the hero of this very long book is the living king, who is the embodiment of both religion and politics, and the just king. And since that has to be Shah Ismail, for whom he's writing, so the selectivity of these narratives that he picks from the past, has to do with glorifying this particular type of political personage. Now, he's relying on a tremendous amount of earlier literature, but that does not mean that this is empty or easy repetition from earlier sources. It's very, very particular and selective, and even within the selection, it is made emotive through the use of poetry of the type that I mentioned earlier. Now, one of the other interesting things about this is if we collapse the narrative as we have here. So one of the critical things is the overlapping of timelines. So time is not something that begins with the year zero and then now we're in 1524. Time is fundamentally embodied and it changes, right? So the Chinggisids and Timurids are overlapped in some way. The Persian and Arab kings and the prophets are also overlapped in some way. And one of the interesting things is he does not attempt in any way to relate these or to resolve them in some way. He does not provide them different, it doesn't say, well, okay, so we can say such and such Persian king was at the same time as such and such biblical prophet. He's fundamentally not interested in that as far as I can tell. And the same is true for all these other overlapping timelines. So this is, goes to the idea that the embodiment of the embodiedness of time is the fundamental principle here. And that basically different lineages are different times. There are multiple temporalities that are the background for his own production. And those multiple temporalities are kept alive throughout. They come together in a figure like Shah Ismail at the end, who embodies all these multiple temporalities at the same time. But if we leave that question aside, there is a multiplicity to time that is a fundamental aspect of this type of narrative. Okay, so this is one kind of imagination of time. Now, so from that I want to move to the second text, which is a work on the city of Herat, Esfezari's Rawzat al-Jannat fi Awsaf Madinat Herat, Heavenly Gardens Describing the Excellent Qualities of the City of Herat. So this is dedicated to Herat, it's not the universe, which he sticks to actually in the writing of the text. But from the very first sentence, we get a clue of what does Herat mean. The first sentence of this text is, gratitude and glorification are rightfully due to that owner of the created cosmos who adorned the city realm of the human body, the enthronement place of the king of spiritual knowledge, with the four bazaars of the elements and the five doors of the senses. Now here, there's a homology between the city and the human body, the prototype of the human body. So we have, just as the human body has the bazaars of the elements, is made of the elements that are being traded in the body as its functions, and it has the five doors of the senses, it's being accessed in various ways, things are going in and out of it through the senses. Similarly, the city is to be perceived as this organic entity that works in a very similar way. And then the critical thing, the enthronement place of the king of spiritual knowledge. Now, this is referring to long Sufi discourse that is very much in the background of much of this material, in which the idea is that the human heart is the throne of God, that the throne of God in the heavens cosmologically is an entity that is inherently interlinked to the human heart. And there's things associated with Hadith Qudsi, statements attributed to the Prophet Muhammad that are not in the Quran, but that's speaking God's voice, which says that the only entity that can tame me, God is saying, is the human heart. And so now, if this is true, and if the human heart is this, then the city becomes a sanctified realm. Just as the human body is the most perfect of entities, this city is the perfect entity, and then it is imbued with sanctity and it's sanctified, just as the human heart is does that for the human body. Now, this kind of thing continues on. So here are verses that he cites from an earlier chronicle, Khwaja Tariq Salmani. He says, Herat among cities, the eye and the lamp, the life force that animates the world's body. If Khurasan is the chest on the spread of earth's surface, Herat then is the heart within in the sense of its true meaning. It is the flourishing abode of God's friends and the axial point of knowledge, religion, and the just. Heaven's fragrant breezes are manifests in its undulating winds. Water of life impregnates its pure dust. Its purity causes the beauty of paradise to grow jealous. Its air is the envy of spirits and sweet-smelling herbs. Her desecal pleasures and pride exceed one upon the other, and its caretaker is also the angel, the heavenly garden's keeper. Reaching beyond, surpassing the grandeur of heavens, it rules in the manner of the blazing sun. Now, this is the kind of encomium that we can find a gazillion of. Pretty much any city, any inhabitation that will be talked about, as a major place in this literature and this period, we can have literature of this type associated with it. So it's actually, so in some ways, if you read it after being used to this kind of literature, this is actually fairly banal. But within the banality is something very interesting with respect to time. If the city is to be perceived in this way and compared to paradise, and it has these eternal qualities, it actually exists outside of time. The thing about paradise, the way in the Islamic imagination, is that it does not have a past or a future. Things don't develop. Things happen instantly, and desires are satisfied instantaneously. There is nothing to be achieved. Everything has been achieved already. So paradise is an entirely paradoxical place, precisely because of these things. And by these extensive connections being made between paradise and the city, there is a way in which time is stilled, in which the city as an entity comes to be, come to stand outside of time, right? Now, if this is the case, then what does one do with the fact that things actually change? People come and go. So in a way, if the city is to be perceived like the body, the time becomes like blood. It's flowing within. Things change within. Different dynasties come. Different people come and die. But the city remains the same, just as the shape of the human body remains the same. And this is a perspective that he carries forward in the way the text is actually organized. I will show you what I mean. So this graphic will just show you how the text goes. So in the beginning, there's a preface, the praise of God, Muhammad, kings, princes, nobles, the poet and Sufi Jami, the main mosque of Herat, then the fort. This text stands outside of the notion of the garden. But then he says that this book is going to be organized into 26 gardens. Gardens 1 through 5 are actually on geography, origins, toponyms, surrounding countryside, province of Khurasan, adjacent regions and cities. It basically fixes the city and its eternal structures and its placement on the surface of the earth. After that starts time. Then we have gardens 6 through 8 on the Islamic conquest, the Samanids, the Ghurids, the Karts. Then gardens 9 through 12, Timur and his rivals. Gardens 13, 14, Shahrukh, it was Timur's son, the next king. Then 15 to 22, various Timurid princes. This is basically the 15th century, most of it. And then he ends, the last three are on Hussein Bakara, the king at this great court that I talked about earlier. Now, the majority of the narrative text that is concerned with temporal progression is actually from 1370 to 1492, right? So it's a earlier history from 650 to 1370 is heavily compressed. But then it expands much, much farther in the latter parts of it, as you can see here. Now here, what it ends up doing that in terms of the affect it creates is that time is tied to space. The time becomes this milling around of human beings and dynasties, etc., on the eternal space, going back to this comparison to paradise that I began with. Now, this is a fundamentally different way of representing the past than the first case in terms of the impression it creates. It is tied to the local, right? So it's the locality here and now that can be experienced, that is to be taken as eternal. And it is paradise. There's no other paradise outside of here. And then it gives a very different charge to how identity is to be constructed as a human being. Okay, so from there to the third text, a poetic memoir by Zainuddin Wasifi, called The Badai Bokhoi, Marvelous Occurrences. And this is a very different type of text. So he begins actually by saying something very interesting, and he begins by saying, why ought one to write? What is the impetus to writing? And he justifies the act of writing by referring to two things. One, he talks about Kiram al-Kadirin. These are two angels that are mentioned in the Quran that sit on the two shoulders of the human being and write everything that the human being does to produce the good and the bad in terms of the acts that the person commits that will be weighed at the end of time. So he says, if God has created the world such that everything that is being done is to be written, then therefore there's something important about writing the events. Writing. So there's a kind of justification for history here through this reference to this theological construction. Then he says, now how do we actually do good and bad things? That we have to know what the Prophet did. So hadith is the second thing that he cites for justifying the writing of history. And then he places the writing of the text at a very particular moment, which is translated here. So he says, recalling the time when in the domain of Khorasan, they were protected from calamities and accidents, the swelling sea of sedition was raging with waves touching the peaks of heaven, and horde-like cloud banks of misfortune and inquisition had darkened away the morning sun of peace and security. Blood was pouring out from people's brimming eyes like red wine pours from flasks. An inverted fortune, fallen from the sky, was driving their wretched heads low with sorrow and grief. The Qizilbash's bloodletting and the visible parts of their red crowns cast a pall to make the sky at the time of evening prayer turn the color of a field of tulips rather than pansy-like purple. Fate's pen was imprinting upon the page of times the interpretation of the verse, "He will cause corruption in it and spill blood." Every beautiful piece of land where the Qizilbash take over, time turns into something like a field of tulips. Now, obviously, he's opposed to the Qizilbash, who are taking over the city of Herat at the time. This is the Safavid conquest of Herat. He is a Timurid, he's a Sunni, these people are Shi, so there's a sectarian background to this. But you can sort of see that this is, in terms of, if we talk about texts that are invested in metaphors, this fellow takes it to a level that is not present in the other two ones. And just translating this bit was required an immense amount of juggling with the original because of its complexity and the all kinds of nuances in the text. But here, the other thing is, again, you can see the ink and blood business here. So the blood flowing produces this... is connected to the fundamental moment in which he starts writing. But the other thing that is here that is different from the other sources is when he says, fate's pen was imprinting upon the page of times the interpretation of the verse, "He will cause corruption in it and spill blood." And before that, there is this, again, this notion that inverted fortune fallen from the sky. So the way that this text is constructed, what he's invested in is that life actually is a kind of competition between two different types of writing. One is the writtenness of fate, which is decreed, and the other one is the writing that we do as human beings, particularly the writing of poetry for him. There's a kind of competition. If the world is dominated at a point when fate takes over, then the pen actually stops writing and produces oppression. The only way to counter fate is by writing, by expressing through poetry. And the text is constant, it shows this constant back and forth between these two types of destinies connected to the question of writing and writtenness. Now, to give you a little bit more of a sense of how the text proceeds, so actually let me show you this one here first. So this is a map of Central Asia. So down at the bottom is Herat. This is working.
It was working a moment ago. That's the light. The red center.
Okay, thank you. So we have Herat over here. What happens is that basically he narrates this text where the story that because of the Qizilbash taking over, he basically has to leave Herat to go into exile, and most of his life is spent in Central Asia. And he travels to Bukhara, then Samarkand, then Turkestan, way up north, and then back to Tashkent. And he actually then spends most of his life in Tashkent. So at one moment when he is escaping Herat, and what he says is that he escaped it in the company of a bunch of poets and musicians who were all escaping Herat because cultural life had basically come to an end. So it's deeply invested in this nostalgic sense, almost Proust-like, of the great loss that happened, the great cultural loss when this event occurred. Now, at the point where he says that they come to a place where the party has to split up, some of them are going to Samarkand and others are going to Bukhara. And he says that at this point, there's a kind of competition that happens between people. Everyone is asked to write something on to reflect on this moment that is happening at the time. So there he gives three samples. The first one is a quatrain, like the Pleiades in a moment we had come together, the way jewels become sewn side by side in a garment. All of a sudden, heaven split the thread of that union, flinging each piece away to a different corner of the world. Then a second person replies, "In this disappointing abode, better not to become attached to someone, for everyone on whom you may set your heart, his hypocritical company will be spiritual torture if his demeanor is anathema to your nature, and if his manners accord well with your ways, separating from him will give the taste of death's elixir." And the third, he cites, "I myself composed these verses, when gathered words joined one to the other, make mark pleasureful company. The heavenly sphere takes up enmity and the will to quarrel. Casting 1,000 tricks and subterfuges in the way, it causes separation, as manifest in the letters of farewell." But you can sort of see this issue of fate in writing and fate in human speech constantly going on. The last one, it's very, there's actually a wordplay that he's doing. So what he uses for joining and the coming together, the word he uses is jam, which is made of the letters jim, mim, ayn, which are, when they're written in the Arabic script, they have to be connected together. The letters, the words he uses for farewell is veda, vav, dal, alif, ayn, which have to be written separated out. So the joinedness and separatedness actually is very much, it's just an orthographic reference essentially. So he's metaphorizing script as well as he does this. And this is actually very typical of what we find in when he cites himself in this work. He's an okay poet, but he's not a terribly good poet. He's not a great poet, certainly as Persian poets go, of which there are many, many great ones. But he is a very clever poet. And he's a very clever man. He's very interested in clever turns of phrases. And actually, at one point, he has an interview with Juan Damir, the author of the Chronicle that I talked about first, where it's about the fact that his claim to fame in Herat at the time is that he's the biggest puzzle master. He writes Mu'amma, the puzzle verses. And that's the kind of quality of his writing that comes through throughout this narration. Again, this is a very long text as well, and it's in two volumes. Now, if we move from these little vignettes to how is the text organized, what we come to is a very complex situation. So I have the narrative structure on one side, and if we try to map this to time, so first of all, he has a notion of eternal time. God is beyond time, and God is referred to in various ways. So fate and these things come up in this beyond time situation. He also refers to religious and cultural mythology, again, from anywhere from the Prophet, Hadith, to references to Shahnameh, etc., easily intermingled without any difficulty or any sense of opposition. And for him, poetry is eternal truth. There's a way, the way the control on time in the narrative is actually, he will relate something happened, and then the poetry will come to give it its eternal meaning, its essence, as we see in these verses that I cited a little bit earlier. Now, then we have ordinary time, because this text is associated with very specific things as well. So I tried to map out how this works. And it leads to like a tremendously complex thing. He's jumping around. This is not organized in either one of the two ways previously. He's not interested in chronological time, chronological sequencing at all. What he's motivated by is memory. And it is something happens, and it reminds him of something else. And it's this constant jumping back and forth produces, at the end of the day, a text that is, it comes across as being exceedingly personal. because everything, the ultimate thing, is what reminded him of what. Right, so it's the text is in the first person, and it has this sense of tremendous intimacy. Now, I tried to, to give a general sense for this. So in this way, chronometric time, we know that he's alive from 1490 to 1539. The narrative time works backwards, and it's atomized. The critical moment is 1512. This is the moment when the Kizilbash take over, where I began. And what so this is a way of, there's a kind of jump between 1539, when he's composing the text, and 1512, remembering the time. And then the rest of it, this is one way of thinking about it, is what you have these constant jumps between these two parts of his life, life in Herat, life in exile in Central Asia, giving the whole text a deeply nostalgic feel. And in this very, very atomized and personalized sort of way. Again, producing a very different way of presenting the past than in the other two cases. So then, leading towards the end, so what? This is always a question that one needs to ask of one's work. So what does this all do? Besides keeping me employed and entertained, which for me is a significant thing, obviously. What does it do? Right, so one of my aims in doing this is many of my readings of these materials are based upon reading and thinking about a tremendous amount of historiographic theory that has come about in the past 30, 40 years, a question about how time is perceived, how can we think about time and history and presence, time and emotion, multiple temporalities, and so on and so forth. Almost all of this theorization is based upon Western literatures. But when you look at when the projections are made, they are completely universal, right? As if what comes to pass in Western understandings of history and time, medieval to modern, somehow are universal. And they may be. But certainly we have here a tradition, the Islamic one, spread over 1400 years, intimately concerned with the question of time and identity. So by looking at these materials in the light of thinking about time, I think there is something to be said for advancing the discussion of history and historiography. Now, the other thing is we have this, as I've shown, universal, local, and personal elements and representations of the past. And I think these are significant because although I have separated them out in the three texts, essentially, all the elements that I've talked about are present in each one of these texts, accentuated differently. There are timelines in all three of them, including Vosifi and Esfezari. Similarly, the place is very much there in Habib Siyar, in Juan Damir, as well as in Vosifi. And then the emotion and personality in first person is also there in the other two texts. So part of my thought is by reading these things in new ways, with greater attention to detail, and through these this multiple thematization, we can get to more textured cultural histories of Persianate or Islamic societies. That one of the problems or one of the difficulties with these materials is these are highly formalized literatures, and they are not simply reflecting reality, right? And they are based upon generic convention and so on and so forth. But I'm trying to find a way to read those conventions, those very conventions, as the sources for thinking about culture through a highly comparative and thematized way. And that's the ultimate aim of getting to richer texture histories of Persianate and Islamic societies generally. And then finally, there is kind of a general aim of rethinking what is Islamic history. Now, one of the interesting things, if we think about what we think of what we are taught and we teach as Islamic history, it's a particular arrangement of time. This is an arrangement common to us as academics, certainly in my previous work. It begins with Muhammad, it goes through his dynasties, and we have these empires, etc., etc., up to the present, and we can even put religious developments in certain ways. There is a timeline attached to it. It's the same timeline that we can also find among contemporary Salafis, right? It's a point of interesting contact. Everyone seems to be agreed on timeline for Islam. Now, but this timeline that seems natural to us, that is completely accepted, actually comes from accepting one very particular valorized view of the past, which is closest among the material I've talked about, is to Habib al-Siyar, the first Universal Chronicle. But even there are multiple timelines. And in essence, someone using that text for Islamic history edits out the Persian parts in some way, the Persian kings and things like this. Or when they are dealt with, the Islamic parts are somehow edited. The fundamental thing about this material, at least, is that all those things coexist. And then we have utterly different registers of time available in other types of texts, not Universal Chronicles, through local histories and through affective portrayals, such as in the case of philosophy. So in that way, one of my concerns in some ways in bringing this up is to try to initiate a more complex discussion of what is Islamic history and Islamic time. That they are never single. There is no single Islamic time. They're actually multiple temporalities. And that thinking about those temporalities allows us to eventually, in the hope of rethinking what Islamic history, historiography, etc. is. Now, I want to just very briefly show you this. So this is the plan of the book that I'm writing. So the first, as you can see, what you've been forced to endure is the chapter one, the Ink and Blood. But the first part is my own access to the material and interest is in this cultural life of metaphors. So Ink and Blood, trees, roots, branches, genealogies, and all kinds of ways in which these are major metaphors for thinking about the past. So organic metaphors, gardens and edifices, human-made metaphors, which are again very prevalent. So history is described as a garden with multiple sections. Another text, for example, speaks of history as a nine-story building in which you go up. And those directionalities actually determine how time is to be narrated, etc. And there's some very interesting things that come out in a similar way as I'm trying to talk about Ink and Blood. Visions and auditions. And what I mean by that is specifically the interruption of ordinary sensory experience through visions, through dreams, or things that tell about the past without being substantiated, which is a major source for talking about the past, and auditions, which is disembodied voices telling about the past, which are again a major source. So these are thematized ways of thinking about that. Now, the second part, what I want to do is to go to the implements of the trade from the metaphors to what exactly are the structures underlying the metaphors. So we have temporals, metastructures, calendars, genealogies, apocalypse. The mechanics of time, thinking about what are the presumptions about causality, change, sequentiality, repeatability. As in any kind of historiographic tradition or concern with the past, these are things that have to be adjudicated, what counts as evidence and how it's presented, and so thinking through that. The question of boundaries, spaces and places, others, particularly if we think about materials in India, what does one do with the majority of the population that is not Muslim, whose time is different? How are those times represented? How are they domesticated, changed, etc., in various ways? And gender, obviously, another kind of major way of creating boundaries through genealogies as well as in all kinds of other ways, social boundaries, etc. And then also using painting and architecture to go beyond words. Now, ultimately, the last section is nostalgia and Persian cultural identity. So part of, at least at the moment, my argument is going to be that what makes these societies joined to each other is through their common investment in a particular past. When they write, people are writing to each other across these societies, and even when they're writing across time within these two centuries, the common point is a certain notion of a past described and narrated through these particular types of metaphors. So in that way, there's a politics of nostalgia, there's an expression of nostalgia that actually creates what is Persianate in this sphere. And then ultimately, going from Persianate to then talking about multiple temporalities and the narration of Islamic histories, which I said something about a little while ago, about how we can use this material to ask larger questions about what do we mean by Islamic history and so on and so forth. I will stop with that. Thank you.
Great, thank you very much. We have time for two or three questions here, which I'm sure that you're willing to.
Absolutely.
Do you have time for
yes,
this?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, good. So,
I'm not going anywhere.
Yes.
All three narratives of the past you analyzed here, one being universal history, one being local history, one being personal history, introduce some new approaches to they're both sort of good case studies for Islamic history, but also introduce something that made you decide to work on the period between 14th and 16th century, 14,000 and 16,000. So the first one, the universal, actually connects two kinds of genealogies, unites them in the person of Ismail, and that is something I would like to hear more about in terms of specific context. Then also the other one, the local one, brings forward, there is a new way to use garden as which is very sort of notorious concept in all sorts of writings in Islam, basically being the metaphor of organizing knowledge in a perfect balance and you know, but here it is used for the past and for different pasts, naming them gardens. And then of course the third one, which I find most interesting in the way it relates to something I was trying to think about, is that actually writing as confronting the thing, as a way of confronting the thing. If you could elaborate more on 14 to 1600 here aspect of it, and what, because as representative as they are, all these three works of Islamic view of the past, the writing, they're also offer some distinctive features of writing about the past in that particular period.
Right. Thank you. You know, that's absolutely the critical question, and this is sort of what I'm trying to get at towards the end of this thing about this politics or the nostalgia as being a major marker of the cultural space that is happening in this period. There's one way in which I will give an evasive answer, and that is to say, it's I'm trying to do a history of a particular period in which I don't know that anyone has done the previous or the later period. Right. So what is distinctive about it, in some ways, very difficult to decide, and that's based upon my instinct and having read these things. Certainly, in terms of if I compare this to earlier Persian histories of the same space, they are very different. I think there are different metaphors involved here. Certainly the genealogies are different. Where the Chinggisid and Timurid genealogies are completely naturalized in this space, which is not there in earlier case. So there is something about this moment in which multiple temporalities actually work better than in previous cases. So that's I think one distinctive thing. And then if we think about later times after 1600, then two things seem again instinctively to me to change. What I'm most familiar with for the 17th century is the Safavid histories. They read very different from these sources. How so? It's a little harder for me to say. Now, in terms of I have a kind of an impressionistic answer to that, and as I said, partially evasive one. But I think my hope would be that if I lay this out, then people can tell me, and people who know the other literatures much better as to how they compare or not. Certainly the material conditions change radically after 1600, so therefore there has to be a corresponding change in time that we can see. I mean, maybe, again, 1600 being a very, it's a kind of almost a random date. I mean, what has that got to do with the temporalities we are using? Have their own processes.
Is it random, or is it also there is, of course, in the Ottoman historiography and also early modern European historiography of this period, the apocalyptic, and messianic expectations and millenarianism and something are actually moved forward.
Right, and so it's going from expectation to the aftermath of the expectation,
yes.
And that's part of the reason for choosing that time as the break rather than something like 1500 or 1506 or something like that. Then it gets into essentially then one has to start doing smaller parsings in various ways. So I'm not sure this fully answers your question.
Yeah, well, yes.
But I'm. It's engaging these issues at least.
Yeah.
I mean, Ottoman is very interesting. So, Bidlisi's Hash Behesh reads a lot more like this than anything else.
Yes. Yes.
And so there. So Ottomans are part of this world.
And his history of Selim.
Oh, that I haven't read, but
yeah.
Yes. Right, that's a very good question. I think so. In the texts themselves, those tensions are not on the surface because they're sublimated or resolved in the way that the author presents. But underlying there are tensions. Now, for the most part, the way they come across in the texts are that these are the multiple options that are there. I think if we move from the texts to what is happening in society and what we can say from the text about them, then we can see the clash between the different temporalities. So in the case of Shah Ismail, for example, so representing the two different types of times, right? But then he's a man who's, even if we read his poetry, intensely conflicted between his religious role and then his role as a reincarnate Persian king from ancient times. We can even in the case of last one, for example, Vasifi, there's a competition between fate and the writing that comes across. So there is a tension going on. So I think part of the reason the power doesn't come across in this is because, in some ways, that's presumed, right? I mean, and so I think it's only after I work this out that it will become a little clearer. Now, when we get to the nostalgia part, at the end is how these Persian societies are working with this, that's where we can see the competition question very much, because the Mughals and the Safavids and the Uzbeks and to some degree the Ottomans, they're fighting about the same thing. And so there, the way they come to different types of textual materials, come to utilize them, it becomes very significant. I don't have this here. It's a fantastic painting, for example, of it's an Indian painting of showing the Mughal king who's hugging the Safavid king, Shah Abbas, based upon a vision that he has. And Abbas is about like 2 feet shorter than him and is basically being given a bear hug and looks a little pained. So when we look at the histories that are connected to particular courts and courtly situations, then we can see the contestation over that. And what they're trying to do, though, is all of them want to claim the whole thing for themselves. And so they will all go to these multiple chronologies and multiple timelines and try to absorb them in various ways. And the fun thing in all of this is that the people who are writing this stuff, they're moving between the courts. So they write for one and then they write for the other. And so there's a professional producers of the past whose services are available to whoever wants to pay, whose idea, whose power is to manipulate these discourses.
Thank you very much for the rigorous presentation and for your scriptless outlining and clarity. I have one comment and then perhaps a question after that. It seems to me one of the things I find quite fascinating is the fact that these are literary texts, so you're dealing with artistic productions. And in some sense, I was wondering if my understanding is that you understand genealogies as quite paradoxical exercise, because on the one hand, it allows us some systematization of certain histories, but then the other side of it is that when we get to metaphor, then it becomes elusive and illusory. In terms of the relationship between literature and historiography, to what extent you are also, in connection to your fundamental question, to what extent we can rethink Islamic history, then part of the question is, to what extent can we think of literature as part of that rethinking? In other words, to what extent literature itself resolves the question of what time is all about because of the use of metaphor and other literary devices? To what extent can literature restore history? Because literature is exactly about untruth and about the role of imagination that defines time. So my question really, whether you can say more about literature and the role of literature in this debate about rethinking history, since what you're working on fundamentally are literary texts that tell us a lot about historiography, but more importantly, perhaps, they interrupt and raise questions about the reliability of historiography.
Absolutely, and this is precisely what I'm trying to do, in the sense that in some ways try to erase the differentiation between literature and historiography, right? I mean, one of the constant issues here is, so these, even the Universal Chronicles, etc., about half of these texts is poetry. Right? So why do historians write so much poetry? That's a separate project I'm doing. This is an absurd idea from a contemporary historian, modern historian's perspective. Why are these people writing so much history? And I think it has something to do with the fact that literature and time are fundamentally interlinked. But precisely as you're saying, so one of my thoughts is, the way we do Islamic history now is that we presume that the history is occurring, and the literature just gives us some access to that history. But that's an absurd way of thinking about it. Our only access is through the literature, right? So we can't presume the abstractions that the temporal abstractions we make out of the literature to be the real, and the literature is just metaphor. Those things are actually collapsed. And this is precisely why I think this kind of work can try to subvert some of this. But one of the things that I'm really, really interested in is by saying that it's literature or metaphor is significant, not to say that this is not reality. Reality is metaphor, right? I mean, this is why the title of this book, well, at the moment at least, is Bridging Reality, referring to the famous Arabic saying that metaphor is the bridge to reality. Metaphor and reality are intimately connected, so it's trying to get us back to the materials, and then on the basis of that, multiplying and making more productive our engagement with these materials.
We should probably finish by 6, so Michael,
yeah,
you can have.
I'll try to think very quickly.
Sure.
But kind of bridging from that, can you say something a little bit about kind of both the literary and now the professional function of nostalgia? Because it seems to me nostalgia isn't quite the same thing as, say, valorization. It isn't the same thing as building on ideology on a picture of the past. And since you have these basic hired hands whose skill lies in tinging a particular, kind of occurrence or image or whatever, how does that affect how we read those things rather than just kind of pure, this stands for that?
So I think the way I would go about it is that the fact that they're hired hands doesn't change the relationship between the textual production and the question of identity and ideology, right? I mean, in a sense, they again, if one makes an analogy between modern history, right? Modern national history depends, modern national identities depend thoroughly on national historiographies, right? But there's a cultural place where people like me, or American historians teaching in universities who are trained in this, they're producing, engaging, changing in all kinds of ways narratives about the past, right? Now, this is not a complete analogy, obviously, because we don't have universities, but I think something similar going on. These are cultural classes. And when we look at, one of the interesting things is they often complain a lot about why I'm not getting paid enough. Living in Palo Alto, I can always associate with this as well. So there too, so they have a separate identity as a cultural class, but their efficacy and their employment possibility depends entirely on the classes that can pay. And they are mediators in interesting ways, and in some ways I'm trying to suggest that the coin for them, the cultural coin they produce or the coin they get is nostalgia and the ownership of the past. And to own the past requires to make it nostalgic in the present in a way. This, again, I'm thinking on my feet, but this is sort of where I'm going with this. So they have a common cultural investment in the cultural sphere.
Well, we sometimes have the impression we're being treated to some recycled old talk. It's a privilege to be hearing of a talk that's in the process like this. It couldn't be more fresh. We need to invite you back 9 more times. In any event, there's a little food in the back, so feel free to linger around and talk more. But again, thank you very much for coming, and especially thank you, Professor, for making it work.
Thank you for the invitation. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Yeah.